On January 23rd, WFAE is launching Inside Politics, a new podcast hosted by Steve Harrison and me, Lisa Wharf, about the Republican National Convention and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to the trailer now on NPR One and WFAE.org/insidepolitics.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At 1 p.m. this afternoon, the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump will begin in the Senate as the Chief Justice gavels this piece of American history into session. At issue is whether the president abused the powers of his office by withholding aid to Ukraine and whether he is guilty of obstructing Congress in their attempts to investigate potential wrongdoing. The Government Accounting Office has already ruled that the president broke the law when he withheld those congressionally approved funds to Ukraine. But Republicans are now arguing that even if the president is guilty, nothing he's done rises to the level of the high crimes and misdemeanors outlined by the Constitution. Impeachment is, once again, a political, not a legal process, and politics is likely to be front and center beginning today in a trial that is sure to go on for weeks. Well, maybe not. And this morning, we're going to get a preview. A lot of things are up in the air. Bruce Jenelson joined us several months ago for a preview of the House impeachment process and joins us again this morning. He is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University and former senior advisor at the State Department, and he joins us by phone from Durham. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Nice to have you here. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is here in our Spirit Square studio. And when he's not here, and he frequently is, he's the chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Thank you for coming back.
Always a pleasure.
Let me start with you. As we head into this trial, we are witnessing flip-flopping of historic proportions.
Welcome to American politics.
Flip-flopping at best, hypocrisy at worst from people on both sides. We have Republicans who don't want to call any witnesses or subpoena any documents and who believe the president's alleged wrongdoings don't rise to the level of impeachable standards. Republicans who took the exact opposite position during the Clinton impeachment. And then you have Democrats who said in the 90s that Clinton's lying to the grand jury didn't reach impeachable standards and who agreed with Charles Schumer when he complained in 1999 that the whole process was due to a small group of people who hate Bill Clinton and his policies. Does that sound familiar? That's exactly what Republicans say about Democrats and their feelings about Donald Trump. So this is the third time that a president has faced impeachment trial, but has it always been this way?
Yes. I mean, it has been, if you go back in time and particularly start with Andrew Johnson, the first president who was impeached, the hyper-partisanship was very evident then as it was now. The issue then was about Reconstruction and the president's power to bring the southern states back into the Union, and the Republicans who controlled Congress wanting to exercise their power because Andrew Johnson was a Democrat.
But Democrats this time are calling this a constitutional crisis. They felt they had to act, they said, because this president was becoming unbridled, and an unbridled president with supreme power goes against the Constitution and the separation of powers.
And the fears that the president becomes a monarch.
Right. So is this different than it was during Andrew Johnson's impeachment? Certainly different than Bill Clinton, because that was a different issue.
Yeah. I mean, for Johnson, it was about the removal, ultimately, of the Secretary of War.
Right.
And the Republicans in Congress did not want that to happen because they wanted him, the Secretary of War, to oversee the Reconstruction of the South and not let the president, who by all accounts was, you know, a white supremacist, you know, not wanting equal opportunities and new rights for the freed slaves. Mm-hmm. He wanted to, you know, bring the South back in as is. And I think, you know, what we're seeing now is the concern about presidential overreach, presidential power, and Congress reacting. And this is the idea. We talk oftentimes of checks and balances. This is separate institutions that have to share power, but ultimately try and work with each other or don't work with each other when it comes to governing power.
Republicans, I think, have looked at this and compared it to the Clinton impeachment, Bruce Jenelson, because he's the last president to go through this process, and he was impeached for entirely different circumstances. He lied to the grand jury about having sex with Monica Lewinsky, and some people even then said that didn't rise to an impeachable offense. That's up to debate, I suppose, but the Congress didn't think so ultimately because they acquitted him. But given the nature of the accusations over Trump's dealing with a foreign nation, does that put this instance in a different arena, or is that just a political lens?
No, I think it really is very different. I mean, this one involves the national security of the United States. And it involves the country that has been, for many years, a little bit on and off, but once again, a major adversary, which is Russia. And the evidence of what President Trump has done coming from so many military officials and distinguished diplomats is so strong. For the Republicans to say there's no evidence and it's just a political job, is a total distortion of what the facts are. And then by running this as sort of reality TV, bringing in the kind of lawyers they are, Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, and then having it late at night, is an effort to really deflect, you know, and have the American people not pay attention. And even in 1999, the two sides in the Senate jointly negotiated the rules of the trial. This has been totally Mitch McConnell doing it on his own. And even some members of his party, including our Senator from North Carolina, Tom Tillis, I'm kind of lying a little low, you know, they're not really sure they want to get out there, and then they may want to cast their vote with the party very, very late at night and minimize it. So it's very, very different in so many ways.
Well, let's talk about this, because this trial will begin at 1 p.m. this afternoon, and it goes till 1 a.m. tomorrow morning, and then it will start again at 1 p.m. tomorrow afternoon. And the way that you would think, maybe, well, okay, there'll be a lot of procedural stuff going on at the start of this at 1 o'clock this afternoon, which will be boring and or maybe intriguing because of the political shenanigans going on the floor of the Senate, but that the biggest stuff would be in prime time. But then I heard last night that they're deliberately delaying most of the major information until midnight. So you have 1 hour between midnight and one when nobody will be watching except on the West Coast.
Right.
Is that true? Do you think that can be done? You can engineer it that carefully?
I'm not sure you could engineer it that carefully because we don't know how many amendments to the resolution the Democrats are going to offer. And my understanding is there will be 2 hours of debate for each of the amendments. So that could potentially push things longer. I mean, are senators going to have a dinner break, or are they going to be sitting there in the chamber for the full 12, 13, 14 hours? A lot of this, I think we're just going to have to watch and play out.
And then once each side gets an opportunity to plead their case, I'm told each side gets 24 hours.
Right.
So that would be two full days from one to one,
right,
every day. So that'd be at least 4 days of that after today's
preliminary setting the ground rules.
They're also, Bruce, trying to sequester the press. They put the press in pens. They usually have free range of the Capitol. They can usually walk up to senators and talk to them. But they put them in pens, and those who make it into the gallery to watch the proceedings, even though those proceedings will be on television, will not be able to bring anything into the gallery. They have no electronic devices, no pen, no pad, nothing. And every time they leave and come back, they have to go through metal detectors. And there are some concern that this is going to set a precedent for the future of press relations in the Capitol. The whole thing seems to be designed to keep much of it from the people. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's really interesting. If the Republicans were so convinced that there is no case against Donald Trump, then why not let it fly and have it out there during the day, you know, just let it go? But obviously, they're not convinced of that. And so they're trying to hide this, and making this, any notion that anybody could call this a fair trial is, you know, borders on the ridiculousness of it. And frankly, the kind of precedents they're setting, so many ways that President Trump has broken the norms of the office, his abuses of power, which was really what impeachment was about. It wasn't about, you know, criminal offenses in the civil sense. It was the founders' concern that a president would abuse the power. They've broken so many norms that this is yet another set. And to be honest with you, whatever happens in the 2020 election, it's very hard for political systems to recover from this kind of trampling on its basic practices.
So abuse of power is what he's been charged with one of the articles. But abuse of power is not in the Constitution, and it's the Constitution says bribery, treason, high crimes, and misdemeanors. Where does it say that abuse of power is any of that?
Most scholars would contend that it falls under high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, treason is a very specific charge. Bribery is also a very specific charge.
You know, jaywalking is a misdemeanor.
It is, but what we're talking about is a high crime.
Uh-huh.
And what I think in looking at this through the scholarship, high crimes and misdemeanors means attacks on the state. Things that are done that will harm the government and the state and the country ultimately. And that abuse of power is the specifics of the high crimes and misdemeanors.
So Democrats want to call witnesses and subpoena documents. The Republicans do not, although the Republicans complained all during the House trial that no witnesses had firsthand knowledge of anything, and that was because those witnesses were prohibited by the White House from coming to testify. It still stymies me why they weren't put in jail, because if you defy a congressional subpoena, why don't you go to jail? I don't understand that, but it's over. Aside from calling witnesses, Bruce, and subpoenaing documents, what other things do the Democrats and Republicans disagree on?
I think they disagree fundamentally on whether, you know, it's all going to be a trial or just a show. The Republicans are really, frankly, President Trump has been very close to Putin. This is like taking a page out of the Stalinist trials. Very rigged from the beginning, in this case, to get somebody off, not to convict them. What will be interesting to see is what, if any, role the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts takes. I mean, in one sense, you can be almost very procedural and, you know, just keeping order. But will he rule on certain things?
Yeah.
Because he knows that in the history books, this has been the Roberts Court, and he will be talked about much more than any of the other justices on the Supreme Court. He was appointed by a Republican, for sure. But will he sort of think about the institution and not the party and play a role that would really, I think, upset Mitch McConnell, potentially upset Mitch McConnell's strategy?
Some have said that the way we are, the Republicans at least, are approaching this trial in the Senate approaches something that would be akin to a kangaroo court. That's something that would happen in the banana republic, and something that we, had it been going on in a banana republic, would be highly critical of. Are people talking about this in the rest of the world and seeing it through that lens? And are we close to becoming a banana republic if this becomes a circus and not a trial?
I'm not an internationalist, so I can't speak to what other countries are probably viewing this. They're probably seeing this through the lens of the way a lot of Americans are seeing it, as party loyalty trumping everything else. That's
the way it is in banana republics.
That kind of singular focus on personality politics over principle politics, I think, is really the result of what we have in this hyper-polarized environment.
Well, Bruce, you were a senior advisor at the State Department for years, and you advised several presidents over time. So let me get your take on that same question.
It's very much along the lines that you both have been talking about. I mean, people are saying, you know, what's happened to your system? Tell us again why we should respect you as the greatest democracy in the world. Because in addition, they're getting the back of President Trump's hand. If you're a NATO ally, you know, he's treated you with disdain. If you're an authoritarian out there, you know you can sort of play up to him and get what you want, whether you're the president of Brazil who calls himself the Brazilian Trump, or Turkey or Putin or whatever. And you put those two together, and it really makes it a situation in which American interests are being damaged. It's not just our image. You know, we like to be known as a great country. But fundamentally, the question of, can you trust the United States, even the Iraqis, where we've been for almost two decades, we're practically ready to kick us out of the country, even though we've lost a lot of lives there trying to defend their freedom. So Internationally, it's a total mess.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, a former senior advisor at the State Department. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here, the chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. We will continue in a moment on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about impeachment in the first part of the program today with Dr. Michael Bitzer and Bruce Gentleson. Mr. Bitzer, Dr. Bitzer from Catawba College. Dr. Gentleson's from Duke University. Let me start this segment with a question that came into us from Nelson on Twitter. He says, the president committed no crime. There is no crime in the two articles of impeachment. It is 100% partisan, a total joke. Your reaction?
Sounds like he read the president's answer to the House charges, which the president said, these are not crimes. This is a partisan attack. And I guess, you know, from the question is, does the president have to be charged with a criminal act, a crime?
Well, it's not a criminal procedure, does he?
It's a political procedure. And yes, politics plays into this. But the question is, do you want any president seeking a foreign leader's interference in an election to potentially sway the election
if American companies are forbidden, which the president disagrees with, are forbidden from participating in bribes to do business in foreign countries, they're not allowed to do that. He disagrees with that. He thinks they should be allowed to do that. Then should a quid pro quo, I'll give you aid, but you have to give me something that will help me in my election campaign, would that also be a crime? Wouldn't that be a crime?
I think any president who did that would be subject to impeachment proceedings.
Is it clear in, do me a favor, though, that that's a quid pro quo? And will that come up in this trial?
I'm sure it will come up in the trial.
All right. It takes 51 votes to approve the rules. How many Republicans will have to come over to the Democrat side to reach 51 if there are to be witnesses?
Four.
There are, let me see, 60. I have a 67 here.
That's to convict.
Yes. Okay. In the trial, there have to be 67 votes to remove Donald Trump from office. That would require 20 Republicans. At the moment, that seems highly unlikely. However, if the trial changes minds, because they're going to sit there for 48 hours in silence and actually have to listen or sleep, if the trial changes any minds, that 67 number is achieved, would that also then bar Donald Trump for running from holding office again?
It would remove him from office. The Senate can then impose a ban on all future office holding.
That would be a separate
vote.
And that would be a simple majority vote?
It would be, again, a two-thirds vote.
Really? Okay. What impact, if any, Bruce Gentleson, do you think the Government Accountability Office's ruling that Donald Trump broke the law in freezing Ukraine funds have on this trial? The government, didn't they used to be called the Government Accounting Office? The GAO is kind of the government watchdog. They're nonpartisan. So if they said he broke the law, should that play a role in this trial?
It should, and it's not the first statement. You know, it wasn't just the, you know, do me a favor in the transcript that the White House released. It was one witness after another who actually did have firsthand information. You know, Ambassador Sondland had it, Ambassador Taylor, Ambassador Yovanovitch, General Vindman. They all had firsthand information, as well as the whistleblower had it a little bit secondhand, but from reliable sources. And I feel like, you know, when we teach our kids the basic American government history textbook that kids get in elementary or junior high school, really says that the founders' main concern was getting away from this abusive king called George III. And in creating a system, wanted to make sure that nobody could have enough power to abuse it. So we even tried the Articles of Confederation first, which didn't work, where we barely had any powers in an executive. And so the notion that reading those talking points, that it wasn't a crime like, you know, jaywalking or stealing from the bank, it's just talking points. And the fate of the country is at stake.
So I lost my train of thought because I was listening to you. what the role of John Roberts, the Supreme, can he be overruled by the Senate?
Yes.
What's 51. The likelihood of that happening?
It depends on what the issue is and how Roberts frames it. I'm going to be looking at particularly four Republicans, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, maybe Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who's not running for re-election and is very much a kind of institutionalist. A lot of people are talking about Susan Collins, Cory Gardner. You know, if it seems reasonable, those four Republicans could potentially side with the Democrats and uphold whatever Roberts rules. But Roberts is in a position where he's basically just presiding and kind of making the ship run on.
But can he pull the Supreme Court Chief Justice card? Can he play that card? Say, looky, I'm here. It's my courtroom. You're doing what I say.
Well, it may be his courtroom, but he's not the ultimate judge.
Okay.
The senators are the ultimate judge and jury.
And there is some discussion about whether or not Republicans will allow, or they'll try to defeat allowing, any of the information gleaned in the House hearings, any of the witness testimony being submitted into this hearing as part of the trial. If they are successful in getting that suppressed, what does that say about how this country approaches the rule of law?
Well, it really says a tremendous amount. And I think that Mitch McConnell, you know, in some ways more important to him than even what happened to Donald Trump is keeping 51 seats in 2020-21. So the senators that Mike just identified, he's trying to get them off the hook, including Tom Tillis, I would add to that list, Art, from North Carolina here. You know, that's something that could make them very vulnerable potentially in the election. And so McConnell's trying to balance it out, protect his majority, while also doing what the president wants. And if Roberts or somebody were to use even his moral capital, you know, the voice of the Chief Justice, maybe we don't recognize that anymore, but it's a big deal, it could really complicate McConnell's strategy.
So if witnesses were successful in avoiding subpoenas in the House, will they have to respond to subpoenas in the Senate trial, or can they avoid them once again? And if they do, what's the penalty?
You know, for this historic of a moment, mm-hmm. to ignore a subpoena to come to a Senate trial regarding impeachment, I think that would do lasting damage to the person's name and reputation and historical importance. I guess they could say, I choose not to.
There's no criminal penalty. I mean, it seems to me that if that happens, they are successful in avoiding subpoenas with no penalty. Why should I obey the traffic laws? Why shouldn't I shoplift?
It sends ripples through our system of governance.
So in the 240 plus years of this republic, impeachment has gone into session three times. It happened two times in the modern era. It would have happened three with Richard Nixon, but he resigned first. Has impeachment now become normalized as a political tool? And if so, can this government stand?
I guess I would say two things. One on the witnesses. John Bolton has said, I'm happy to be there, you know. Just tell me that I can come. And Bolton probably knows more than anybody because of the role of National Security Advisor. So he's willing to come, and McConnell's trying to figure out a way not to have him come. On your other question, you know, in some ways I fear more that this goes with a show trial. It's dismissed despite everything this president has done. I actually think that does more damage to the president and the republic than if he were convicted and taken out of office.
And yet you say, I read that you said, that if Trump is removed, you would not be comforted that the impeachment process worked because you worry a lot about violence. Are you talking about domestic violence in the wake of his conviction?
I was worried about that in 2016. I'd be worried about that now, and I'd be worried about that in 2020 if he were to be running and lose the election. I think he has been an enabler.
I think we lost him.
The release of that could be very scary for this country.
We lost you just for a second there, Bruce. You think it would enable him in what?
He's been very much of an enabler. You know, his comments after Charlottesville and other times, his comments on this Second Amendment rally in Richmond yesterday. Even with a wink and a nod, not so much go out there, the violence that could be released in this country could be extremely, extremely scary for all of us.
Wow. And what are your feelings from a political scientist's point of view, whether or if the trial goes either way? What do you fear for the country if he's acquitted? What do you fear for the country if he is convicted?
Either way, we are still so badly polarized and divided that it will only intensify the campaign this fall, and I'm not real sure where things go, but other than we will still be bitterly divided
post-November. And who or what could ameliorate that?
You know, I think some Republican voices that say I put country over party. Yeah. You know, that old Profiles in Courage that John Kennedy wrote or allegedly wrote about senators over the years that played that role in the Senate. I think that we really need that now, and Republicans could do that even more than Democrats right now if they're willing.
The rise of a statesman or stateswoman is desperately needed that puts country over party.
Dr. Michael Bitzer is the chair of the Department of Politics at Catawba College. Bruce Gentleson joined us from Durham. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University and a former senior advisor at the State Department. Thank you both for your time. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.